we're meeting the management team for the first time at the pitch, then we have already lost and the chances of winning are next to none. So we put a lot of emphasis on talking to our private equity clients and not only understanding the businesses they own, but making sure that we can actually get in front of the management teams.
Welcome to the X Factor, where we visit with proven private equity-backed leaders to unpack a compelling area of value creation to help our listeners gain an edge as they grind toward a liquidity event of their own. X Factor is presented by Private Equity CXO, the world's largest digital community of PE-backed executives. You can find a link to PECXO in the description to start your free membership and unlock exclusive content. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, a partner at Falcon, a retained executive search firm exclusively recruiting C-level leaders for private equity-owned portfolio companies. Happy to be joined today by my friend and colleague from KeyBank, Arindam Basu, and he's going to help us do our occasional snapshot of the markets. Arindam is an investment banker and does a lot of work in the industrial space, but has broad views of debt markets, transaction markets, deal markets broadly. And we're going to unpack a lot of good information here for our audience today. So Arindam, thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Okay, good deal. So tell everybody about your background quickly and what you do for a living.
Yeah, sure, certainly. So Arindam Basu, I'm a managing director in the M&A group at KeyBank Capital Markets. I've been with Key going on 17, 18 years now, built my career post-business school at Key. I focus primarily, as I said, in the mergers and acquisitions area, but work within our industrial manufacturing sector, focus in metal manufacturing, some degree of specialty materials, and such subsectors within our industrial practice. As we go along, I can give you more background around our practice, but that's just a snapshot of what we do.
Yeah, great. And so for those of you in different sectors, Arindam and I will be covering more macro topics that apply to all sectors that private equity is dealing with from a transactional standpoint. So let's get into it. 6 months ago, someone hit pause on deal flow. Evidently, the debt markets were closed temporarily. People got nervous. Deal flow screeched to a halt. 2023 was a 10-year low in transactions for private equity. But it seems like the pendulum's beginning to swing back to some semblance of normalcy. So just tell us what you're seeing in the macro around the deal markets as this year gets underway and maybe any outlook for the rest of 2024.
Yeah, certainly. It's more like 18 months ago, not necessarily just six, but it seemed like 2023 had a very significant and steep fall off in deal volumes, even compared to 2022. Where 2022 itself was somewhat of a fall off because so much got done in calendar 21 coming off of the COVID year. 2023, because of the pace and level of increase in interest rate, is probably the single biggest driver of deal activity falling off, primarily because the private equity activity didn't grind to a halt, but it was significantly off compared to prior years, both on the sell side and on the buy side. On the sell side, people's bid-ask spread and valuation expectations didn't quite reset in line with how things were morphing in the financing world. And on the buy side, in certain cases, with the speed of the rate increases, the debt markets dried up. And at some point, the sort of the math stopped working on valuation, considering the leverage levels were just not there. And the leverage levels were not there, both in terms of quantum, as a multiple of EBITDA, as well as the cost. And we'll get into this more. The cost really started mattering a lot when you go from sub 2% spreads to 4-5% money, and then the spreads on top of it, even if the spreads were consistent, it still has had a huge impact on the cash flows for debt service, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So all that impacted the profile of the transactions that were in market, ability for private equity to be active, and then, as I said, the bid-ask spread on valuation expectations. To your point, starting, I would say, late last year, I think we're starting to see activity come back to market. Several factors. One is, I think, the comfort level that people have now at this point that the increase in rates have more or less stopped. At this point, I don't think anybody's expecting the Fed to raise rates going forward. The question is going to be, when will the Fed start cutting rates? So the increase has gone away. And so therefore, the predictability of cash flows and predictability of, okay, what that implies has gotten better. At some point, private equity in particular has to restart doing deals. They are in the business of institutionally just doing transactions. They are sitting on a lot of capital. They're also sitting on investments that they need to monetize. And time is of the essence when it comes to those sorts of funds, trying to wrap up some of their funds or wrap up transactions. That activity level will pick back up. And we're already starting to see some of that, both in terms of our own backlog, our own pitch activity, and what we are hearing from the marketplace about other private equity clients preparing their portfolio companies to come to market. So to your point, yes, activity levels are picking up, but there is still a fair amount of corporate transactions in the market, including our own. Having said that, activity levels are picking up. Where it still is a little bit of a struggle are sectors that are purely math-oriented, i.e. spaces like real estate, where the cost is still meaningfully high and the impact thereof on transactions will continue to be high. The level of transactions in the real estate space is probably still going to be muted compared to prior years, but that's less of an impact to private equity clients than to other sort of REITs and a completely separate sector. Now, industrial space, transactions should pick up meaningfully in 2024.
And I don't have data on this, but anecdotally, in what we do for a living, talking with executives who are going perhaps through sale processes, and we're trying to time conversations about our opportunities with when they might be looking at a closed transaction, it seems to me that the number of failed auctions has increased significantly. I don't know if there's data on that anywhere, but again, anecdotally, I'm hearing more and more often that we went to market, we got final bids, and our private equity sponsor believed that they were undervaluing the company, and we'd rather just kind of reset for another year or two to see if we can get a better deal at that point. I don't know what you're seeing on that front or if there's a source of data to back up my anecdotal sense.
No, you're right. That information is always mostly anecdotal, because although publications like Merger Market do come out some from time to time with a list of transactions that hit the market, but then nothing happened. But it's hard to say for those transactions why it didn't happen, whether it was a valuation gap, whether it was business conditions or whatnot, right? When I talked about the bid-ask spread issues, in 21, 22, several industry segments, be it in manufacturing, in metals, et cetera, for a variety of reasons, underlying EBITDA numbers really spiked up, sometimes due to pricing, sometimes due to other factors. And EBITDA really moved up significantly in certain cases. And therefore, correspondingly, maybe the valuation expectations moved up for the sellers, whereas buyers were more of a prove-it mode around sustainability of that EBITDA profile. To give you an example, we sold a business, and this transaction is a little old now. It closed in late 2022. But that business, we started working with the sellers in 2021, and coming out of COVID, this is a business that went from roughly $12 to $15 million of EBITDA to 50 of EBITDA while we were in market. And a lot of it was price-driven.
During a sale process, a 4X move on EBITDA?
Yeah, well, LTM. And thankfully for us, our client, the private equity client, was very pragmatic about it, that we will not be able to prove sustainability for that level of EBITDA increase. So to expect that you will get the same multiple off of 50, of what you might get off of 15, was just not going to happen. And we tried to put forward what is the more sustainable level and how much has the business really grown in fundamentals, in volume and increase in locations or volume or fundamentals like new customers. And that part is sustainable. Sustainability of that side is more provable and debatable than pricing. So if you eliminate the pricing jumps and the volatility around in pricing, then what is the fundamental sustainable EBITDA? And we landed at somewhere in the, call it $20 to $25 million level. And our client was very pragmatic about it. And we got a good deal done. It went from private equity to private equity. So it was a secondary transaction. But the private equity buyer had good experience in that space. And they had another portfolio company that had some similar businesses. And therefore, a transaction like that got done with several factors lining up where the seller's expectations were more, I'd say, reasonable and practicable, and the buyer could see the fundamental growth in the business and even adjusting for that pricing dynamic. And that business is still doing very well. It's not, it's obviously come down from 50, but it's still well north of 25. So yeah, it's been a good deal on both sides. But there are several transactions like that where books went out, not necessarily our transactions. So the book went out, and if the sell side advisor won the mandate saying, yeah, I'm going to get you a fulsome valuation on an EBITDA profile that 3 to 4x and normal, those kinds of transactions didn't get done. It just didn't get done. And not only because of the bid ask, but also how do you finance something when there's been such a huge uptake? We are in a significantly inflationary environment, and you don't know, what's going to happen in a year from now. And who's going to be that private equity partner who's going to go to their investment committee and say, yeah, I'm gonna buy this business at full valuation on a significantly high EBITDA profile.
Let's say there's a more normalized LTM trend line of EBITDA for a business that went to market in 23, and the sellers were hoping for, I'll make something up, a 12x EBITDA valuation, and the market offered 10, and they decided to keep that asset and try again in another year or two. Interest rates, let's pretend they'll be about the same level in a year as they were last year during this imaginary failed auction. What might cause that valuation and therefore EBITDA multiple to increase enough to get that same deal done? The only thing I can think of as a bystander to all this is the pent-up demand of, at some point, private equity has to get liquidity. And so they will sort of moderate some of their maybe pie in the sky valuation wishes. And on the other side, at some point, the buyers in private equity have to deploy capital. Is there anything else that might contribute to an increase in multiples despite maybe a static rate environment?
If for some reason the that particular company should have garnered, say, interest from a strategic buyer or several strategic buyers who chose to, at that point of time last year, in your hypothetical example, stand on the sideline for whatever reason. That could be one case. The institutional investors on both sides, on the sell side and the buy side, they don't always think in terms of multiples arbitrage, right? They're very pragmatic about it. We had a client last year, or a prospective client, whose portfolio company were working on securing some long-term agreements with key customers. This is a business in the aerospace and defense sector, primarily aerospace. So while that was out there, we, in our pitch, we said, hey, you got to get that done, because if you leave that uncertainty on the table, your valuation multiple and just growth interest level will be impacted. So if you get that done in the next, call it 7 to 8 months, and come to market later, that would be ideal. And they agreed with it. And fast forward, they have not only gotten it done, but they've gotten it done under better terms and longer LTA. So using that example, that's one reason why one would not take a business to market, but that's not necessarily a reason to hold back a business that has already gone to market. Nobody likes to have failed auctions on their hands, particularly institutional investors. So they would try to do, if a business is in market, they would try to do everything possible to close that out rather than have a failed auction on your hands. But a fair bit of those happened last year, just given the dynamics we talked about around spike in EBITDA and bid-ask spread.
I see your comment on the presence or absence of strategic competitors, because I think most of our audience knows, back in the day, strategics were reputed to always have the deepest pockets and pay the biggest price. Now that pendulum's kind of swung toward there's so much private equity capital out there that they're at least on par, if not more aggressive than strategic bids. But if that strategic catalyst isn't part of the auction process, that can maybe help prices slip a little bit from where they otherwise might have been had that participant been involved.
Think of it as the typical public company transactions where there's a strategic, especially if it's a public company, it's trading at X, and if it can always do an accretive transaction if it pays something less than X, right? It's as simple as that from a math standpoint. And as the markets traded up last year, strategics got aggressive, especially in businesses that they just absolutely had to have. I sold a business last year in that particular space where it was a family-owned business, a fairly good size, and a strategic public company buyer who was leaps and beyond any other private equity, actually even other strategic buyer, because they just had to have that business. In a situation like that, it's hard for private equity to be competitive, particularly in the current rate environment. When rates were near zero, private equity was very competitive. In this current environment, the math makes it very hard to be competitive if a strategic or a couple of strategic buyers are running that last, two horse race.
Yeah, let's take a quick diversion into deal structure, if you don't mind. So prior to kind of rates increasing, my layman's explanation to folks would be, okay, private equity is going to do a deal. They're going to put 4 to 6 times EBITDA on it, and then they're going to round out the rest with equity. And because of a host of factors, depending on the sector, debt can represent a meaningful portion of the structure, up to and including 50% or even more. But now, with interest rates rising, it's not just the question of debt multiples, but coverage ratios, as you and I were discussing earlier before we started the show. So just explain to our audience what coverage ratios are and how they go into factoring how much debt a sponsor might want to put on a deal.
So I'll caveat, this is debt stuff coming from an M&A guy, so be careful what you're hearing. But in general, if you think about the typical LBO, the typical private equity deals, whether primary or secondary transaction, those are financed by the senior debt is cash flow based financing, right? In some cases, some companies, they can be a component of cash flow and ABL financing, but let's talk about a simple cash flow based financing. Previously, when rates were near zero, and we were pricing debt off of LIBOR. Those were the days. And if it's a LIBOR plus 300, LIBOR plus 400, your all-in rate is, call it 4.5%, 5%. So if you're a $20 million EBITDA business and you just got yourself 5 times leverage for the private equity firm to do a, call it a 9 times deal, so your actual debt to equity is slightly above 50%, close to 60%, let's say, coming into the deal. Yeah, you have $100 million of debt, you're paying 5% all in. No, not a huge deal for a $20 million EBITDA business. Fast forward today, and we price debt off of SOFR, which is not very dissimilar from LIBOR, except it's set by the government, except not set by individual bankers or a group of bankers. But it's SOFR plus 500 is all of a sudden 10% plus money. So if you have $100 million of debt between your interest and some level of principal amortization, you have more than 10, call it $12 million of P&I that you have to cover. So that's the coverage. What it used to be, the cash flow based financing used to have certain covenants, and the covenants used to be more around how much max debt you would have. Let's say the covenant is set at 5.5 times, and your EBITDA dips a little bit and you bust that covenant, no big deal. But the covenants are also set with some, not only at leverage covenants, but there are also some coverage ratios, which means if you have a certain amount of debt, then based on EBITDA you have and your CapEx profile, you have to have principal and interest coverage as well as pay for your CapEx. So those are the things in the current in rate environment that has become more important. Those are the driving factors today. And using my example, if you're a $20 million EBITDA business and you're paying $12 million, let's say, in P&I coverage, and you have $5 to $7 million of CapEx to continue to grow the business, all of a sudden you really don't have any remaining cash flow, any slack in the system. And all of a sudden, if there's any cycle, which particularly people were not quite sure if we are entering into a recession or a soft landing, if there's any sort of EBITDA cycle, all of a sudden it dips down to 15 million, say 16 million, it becomes very tight for the CFO and the CEO to the management team to manage that business and continue to finance growth if need be. So those are the things that became the tails that wag the dog, so to speak, in the mathematical space around debt cover.
Yeah, I know a lot of our members experienced that firsthand as 23 unfolded, that they entered the year with a certain interest rate and ended the year with a much higher rate. And that interest expense rose as the quarters unfolded and heavily impacted their ability to execute on the budget that had been set during the lower rate environment.
decision makers, it becomes important to see, okay, how does the math work during your hold period, right? If you're relying on a certain profile, a debt profile during your hold period, you're going to end up at a certain, even if you don't assume any sort of multiples arbitrage at the entry and the exit, then even if the multiple remains the same, but you grow your EBITDA to a certain extent, the amount of the interest cost, the cash interest cost, has an impact on the math over the course of time.
Yeah, I think we do a lot of content on CXO around helping members diligence a would-be opportunity that they're thinking of joining. And I think an important question they might want to consider asking is, what is your coverage ratio currently? And tell me about any slack in the system as we try to grow this thing. Because if the mandate is to do a wonderful job of value creation from an operating standpoint, and there's zero or negative slack, that's a tough proposition for anybody, no matter how talented they are.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Okay. Let's pivot over to sort of transactions themselves. And there's going to be a lot of them in the next period, I think we all hope. So when portfolio companies get ready to go to market, they sort of get the data room organized, and then they're going to think about selecting a banker. What is your experience in terms of how much influence management can or can't have in banker selection, given that it's a majority-owned private equity situation and a lot of them are fairly determined to do what they'd like to do rather than be accommodative? But what do you see on that front around any management influence that might exist?
Yeah, we think management certainly has influence, whether or not they're significant owners in the business or not. Where they have more influence is if they are significant, if the CEO, CFO combined to own, call it 15% of the business, let's say I'm just using a number, they certainly have more influence than if they were just brought in within the last 18 months, maybe to prep the business for a sale. They would probably have less of an influence. But management teams always have influence because the private equity sellers want to make sure that they are happy working with the advisor that was picked. Two forms or examples that I would use in this case is the business that I mentioned, the example that I gave to you earlier during our conversation. That was one where the previous management team had used to own the business. And they sold to the private equity firm, and the CEO still owned by himself on 12% of the business, and the management team owned north of 15%. So they had a very strong influence on who they picked. Versus others, we're working on a situation right now where a CEO, she was brought in last year. She was brought in to fix certain things and maybe prep the business for a sale. She's not a meaningful owner, but certainly had a say, perhaps maybe a little bit less so. But certainly, management teams always have a say in who's picked. We like to say that if we are meeting the management team of a company for the first time at the pitch, even if we knew the private equity firm beforehand, if we're meeting the management team for the first time at the pitch, then we have already lost and the chances of winning are next to none. So we put a lot of emphasis on talking to our private equity clients and not only understanding the businesses they own, but making sure that we can actually get in front of the management teams, meet the teams ahead of time. We do a lot of non-deal related sort of road shows or private company conferences where we try to get the management teams in front of other parties and just get to know the companies better and the teams better before we end up getting invited to a pitch. Because invariably, those are a lot better situations, and we are poised a lot better to win those mandates than, as I said, meeting the team for the first time at the pitch.
Yep, sounds good. And then two final topics to kind of cover off on transaction related. So we're in the transaction, we've got LOIs coming in, and of course, private equity is compelled to go with the best bidder, which is often the highest bidder in terms of signing up on the IOI or the purchase agreement. But management, you know, may have some misgivings about being handed off from what they see as a constructive, good partner private equity firm to one that could potentially be more draconian. Can management have any influence in who the buyer is when it's a secondary buyout, in your experience?
I would say that's a little bit more rare at the end of the day. If it's something like, I'm making up a number again, $200 million deal versus a $210 million deal, maybe that's something. If it's a significant difference of a couple of turns of EBITDA, probably not. At the end of the day, the management team that's part of the sell side is also in also incented to maximize proceeds. So their option pool will be based on maximizing proceeds. So it's also meaningful for them to say, okay, you know, we'll live to fight another day and take the highest bidder. I'd say there have been situations, probably less so in my own specific experience, but there have been situations where what you're saying has happened. But those are situations where perhaps it's a strategic buyer versus a private equity buyer. Perhaps the numbers are fairly close to each other, and you can, to a certain extent, determine your near-term future. This goes back many, many years, but there was a transaction where at the very end of, or very close to the end of the transaction, just before we were signing things up, the sell side management team said that the CEO said that he didn't want to work for a particular person on the buy side if that company was going to be the buyer. And we sort of chuckled, okay, how do we determine what an HR decision might be for a buyer after a transaction is done? It's their business and they'll do whatever they want to do. But we still were able to have a discussion, and some certain promises were made as part of the incoming management team's contract structure. Things were sort of lined up where people got comfortable, but those are few and far between.
Yeah, you're right. Of course, through the use of the management incentive pool, management is aligned in their interest to maximize value with the private equity firm. I just think it gets a little tricky when you're talking about a secondary buyout. And if it's a less than appealing sponsor that is in the lead and, for example, has unusually high rollover requirements, and now all of a sudden management's sort of saying, okay, I've got to roll an awful lot. They're paying a high price, so they're going to expect the world from us. They may not be happy with what they're really getting. Yes, I will have made more on my liquidity today, but the strike price on my go forward options is now more difficult to crest. So it just gets tricky. But my advice to executives is get through the transaction, get your liquidity event, and then figure out if you like your new partner within that first year of the new relationship.
Yeah. And to your point, it goes to how much power does the management team have from the get-go. If it is significant ownership and they can say, I have a certain contract right now, and what I'm getting is nowhere close to that. Mm-hmm. And there's no way I'm signing that contract. And if I'm not signing that contract, that deal will never close. So you definitely have that power, but do you want to exercise that power? And do you want, nobody wants to burn bridges with existing ownership. So it really becomes a little bit of a tricky situation if indeed that's the case, that they see the writing on the wall, that this is not a group that they would want to work with long term. Having said that, most private equity parties are, in this day and age, everybody wants to make sure that their investment is successful. If they end up in a situation where they will not necessarily hold on to the current management team, but they have other operating partners or other ex-CEOs that they will absolutely put on top of this business and replace the CEO. I think those kinds of things become evident fairly early, and people go into these deals with eyes wide open that might happen. And because it's best for both sides to be aligned. Like, this is what I'm going to do once I take ownership, and sort of it is what it is.
Okay, terrific. Covered a lot of great ground. Last question. So many of our members are either in the early stages of a sale process or will be gearing up to execute a transaction later this year. I think there's been a lot written on how management team members can best perform, you know, during those sale processes, be they management meetings or, you know, further down the line. But is there anything you've seen that is kind of an interesting takeaway or the one thing that either individuals or collective teams can do to best optimize their chance of maybe that extra half turn of EBITDA on the bid?
Yeah, it's a combination, and we like to say that it's a combination of both preparation and execution. The preparation side, having all the good due diligence items ready, not only financial, but operational, environmental, strategic, and getting all the ducks in a row, getting any major holes filled. If you need a chief development officer, or if your finance side has any open holes or anything like that, those sorts of things filled, the preparation angle is extremely important. That's why even when we get hired, we say that we may end up spending another extra month or so on the preparation side rather than going to market too early. And then on the execution side, especially over the course of a transaction, which can take anywhere from 4 to, say, 6 months, 8 months in certain cases, executing upon what you said would happen in the near term is extremely important. So therefore, certainly not suggesting people sandbag near-term projections, but setting yourself achievable goals over the next several months or a couple quarters is extremely important, making sure that particularly strategic items, whether it's a new customer agreement or a certain growth-oriented investments that you're executing upon, or certain cost-saving elements. Say, for example, you plan to shut down a plant, that make sure that as you go through the transaction that you're able to really execute upon it and demonstrate either the growth in EBITDA or the cost savings coming to fruition or the customer win coming to fruition. Those kinds of things are extremely important. So incremental small wins being communicated over the course of the process are extremely helpful in not only the success of a process, but to your point, maybe getting that extra half turn, a turn as you go through the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the way you phrase that. It's you know, it's one thing to be reporting out to your existing private equity owner at minimum monthly and quarterly results, but once that sales process is underway, now you've got a number of stakeholders that you're reporting results to, and they're comparing actual in the current period to what was projected in the SIM. And as we all know, SIMs are usually optimistic and certainly achievable, but you want to make sure that that near-term performance is in line. That's easier said than done, given all the distractions of selling a company. We think Absolutely. Of it as a second full-time job. Well, Arundhem, this has been great. Thanks so much for covering a lot of ground with us, from the state of the market and transactions to a little bit of a finance 101, and then some performance issues that can help our members optimize and get to the finish line, and hopefully for a premium price. So thank you so much, and we'll have you back again soon if you're willing.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, it was fun. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Be sure to tune in to our next episode. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, and thank you for listening to The X Factor.